This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mark Salzman, describes himself as an agnostic, but his new novel, Lying Awake, is set in a Carmelite monastery outside of Los Angeles and is about faith. Sister John is a nun who has recently begun having divine visions where she feels the presence of God. Her inspired writings have earned her new respect in the order. But when she learns that her visions may really be caused by a brain tumor, she descends into a crisis of faith. Writing about this book in The New Yorker, Lawrence Weschler describes Salzman as having achieved something approaching a perfect little novel. Salzman's other books include the memoir Iron and Silk, about his 2 years in China studying martial arts, and The Soloist, a novel about a cellist who was a childhood prodigy but has lost his gift. Let's start with a reading from Lying Awake. Sister John has gone to a neurologist because of the headache she's been having. He's run some tests. In this passage, she's waiting for the doctor to give his diagnosis.
Dr. Shepherd stepped in, greeted her, then opened her file across his knees. As he turned the pages, a pamphlet slid out of the file and onto the floor. The cover showed two healthy-looking people smiling at each other. Under that image, Sister John saw the title, Living with Epilepsy. She felt the blood rush out of her face and limbs toward her heart, protecting it from the sudden chill. Sister John had come prepared to hear bad news about her health, but not about the state of her soul. She knew quite well that one of the first questions asked of anyone wishing to become a cloistered nun was, "Have you ever been treated for mental illness or epilepsy?" If the answer was yes to either question, the candidate was automatically rejected. Epilepsy was particularly feared because of its reputation for producing compelling but false visions. Doctors and clergy alike had referred to the disease for centuries as holy madness. "Please, God, take anything. Take my life, but don't take yourself away from me. Don't tell me I haven't known you at all." The doctor picked the brochure up without comment and put it back into the file. "The results of your tests are back," he said, "and while it might not sound like good news, I think you'll see that it's not so bad either."
That's Mark Salzman reading from his new novel, Lying Awake. Mark, what kind of epilepsy does the nun in your story have?
What she has is a variety called temporal lobe epilepsy, which is interesting because it doesn't necessarily cause the kind of physical symptoms that we usually associate with epilepsy, convulsions, loss of consciousness. The seizures can be experienced psychologically. And something that's really interesting about this disorder, which for a long time was known as Dostoevsky syndrome, is that some of the changes in personality that are associated with it are an intensification of emotional life, increased concern with philosophical, religious, and cosmic matters, and a general sense of illumination, mission, and fate. And so I just thought it would be a wonderful problem if someone who is already dedicated to religious life were to develop the symptoms of that disorder in midlife.
How would you describe the questions that the novel asks about religion and neurological disorders?
Well, the nun is faced with the question, once she's diagnosed as having the disorder, and the doctor explains to her that the disorder may be causing these intense spiritual experiences she's been having that she's been writing down in poetry and inspiring others with, the question then becomes for her, should she have it treated or not? Because, of course, she's wondering, just because there is a physiological explanation for these experiences, does that mean they're not valid? Are my experiences false simply because some doctor can say that there is a physiological explanation for it? Or did God intend for me to have this disorder in order to be a vessel for experiences that inspire others? So really what it's about is the question of what is real, what is true, what is valid spiritual experience, and what is pathology?
What led you to frame this question and build a novel around it?
Well, it started when I read an article by Oliver Sacks, the neurologist and wonderful writer, about a patient of his who had this disorder, temporal lobe epilepsy. And after reading it, I remember thinking, well, in the case of the patient that Oliver Sacks described, he is not interested in treatment. His seizures give him visual images of his hometown in Italy that are so intense and so accompanied by an emotional sense of fulfillment and peace and harmony that he's convinced that painting what he sees in these visions is his almost religious mission in life. And so he's not interested in being treated. It's the best thing that's ever happened to him. On the other hand, for this nun, the question becomes more complicated because she is dedicated to a life of service, and it may well be that if she does not have the disorder treated, her seizures could eventually become convulsive and intractable, and then she would be a burden to her community. So the real question for her becomes, should I do what is best for me personally, what I enjoy most, or what is best for others?
Now, how did you learn that anyone wishing to become a cloistered nun is asked if they have epilepsy and rejected if they do?
Well, I read about that when I started doing some of the research for the novel early on. I read about that in an article about contemplative religious life, that this is the article was actually about religious nuns or monks who in midlife develop symptoms of mental illness and how the community deals with it. And in passing, they mentioned that it's one of the things that is asked of a potential candidate, because as you can imagine, in a cloistered community, ability to participate fully in the community life is essential for that community to survive. And so if one person is not able to control their emotions or their experiences, it can really be destructive. So I think for obvious reasons, it could be it's a very high-risk thing.
You write that the founder of the Carmelite order, St. Teresa of Avila, had visions and headaches. Did she also have epilepsy?
Well, she's considered a prime candidate for a possible diagnosis of this type of epilepsy, because her she did suffer from seizures, convulsions, comas. She struggled with all kinds of really serious illness, and so quite a few neurologists speculate that she could easily have had this this disorder, and it would explain the nature of some of the visions she had. But it's too far back in time to make a really positive diagnosis. I mention it in the book because, of course, for the nun, Sister John, the fictional character, once she learns she has the disorder, if there's any possibility that the founder of their order could have had the same problem, and it had not been a problem, it had not been an obstacle to her search for God, it would leave open the possibility that for Sister John, maybe it's not the wrong thing for her to, maybe it is God's will that she have the disorder. I just felt that sort of, it complicated the situation a little bit.
But you're right that St. Teresa of Avila called her illness her greatest teacher, but she also warned against seeking illness as a means of cultivating holiness, and she went to doctors.
That's right. Teresa of Avila, Thérèse of Lisieux, another saint from the Carmelite order, they both suffered terribly from illness, and they both felt that, in a sense, illness had been a catalyst for them for a deeper understanding of human suffering and the need for God's mercy. So it was, in a sense, it was a grace for them. But they both were very careful to say, to experience deeper grace, you go out and cultivate illness. Well, that goes against the whole idea of accepting what you are given. And that becomes then a selfish pursuit. If you try to make yourself sick or you refuse treatment in order to become more holy, well, that's a selfish pursuit. You're going against the idea of allowing God to choose what will happen for you and being as capable as possible of being of service to others.
Now, you mentioned in your book that the form of epilepsy that your character has in the novel is named after Dostoevsky because he had it too. What were his symptoms?
Well, very much like the character in the novel, his symptoms were that he would experience several hours of almost a crushing pain, a stiffness of the limbs, and a feeling that he was being just swallowed up and crushed by darkness, but then finally it would burst open in a blinding flash of not visual light, but almost insight. And this is, there's a nice quote where he describes what it felt like. He wrote, "There are moments, and it is only a matter of 5 or 6 seconds, when you feel the presence of the eternal harmony. A terrible thing is the frightful clearness with which it manifests itself and the rapture with which it fills you. If this state were to last more than 5 seconds, the soul could not endure it and would have to disappear. During these 5 seconds, I live a whole human existence, and for that, I would give my whole life and not think I was paying too dearly."
Now, is he diagnosed with epilepsy, or is this in retrospect that we know he had it?
Yes, he was diagnosed. He lived close enough to our time that he was diagnosed with epilepsy. But of course, during his life, there really wasn't much of a the kind of treatment that is available now for it. So he lived with it till the end of his life.
Now, along with this kind of epilepsy comes not only like visions, which can be quite divine, but also headaches, which can be quite painful.
Yes, other unpleasant symptoms can be a sense of dread, a panic, ringing in the ears, or hearing obsessively little bits of music, advertising jingles. Unfortunately, most people who have temporal lobe epilepsy, the symptoms are not pleasant. It's frightening, and it can be quite destructive to your relationships with others because others, it's difficult for them to understand what you're going through. But there are occasionally people for whom the seizures are so ecstatic and so filled with a kind of significance that they become cherished. And those are the people for whom the question of treatment really is very complicated.
Now, the Carmelite nun in your story has to ask the question, you know, if she gets the brain tumor causing the epilepsy removed, will she still have visions? And will she still feel as close to God? Will she still feel moved to be a nun? And I'm wondering if you think there are similar questions that writers or other artists take, such as if you're depressed, as many artists are, and you take Prozac to cure your depression, how will that affect your art or your writing?
Absolutely. I think for every person, it's an individual choice. I think for most people, a depression is such a devastating illness that it is a worthwhile trade-off to cut a little bit of the artistic edge off in favor of preserving your ability to carry on healthy relationships with others, to get happiness from ordinary life as opposed to only from those extraordinary moments of artistic satisfaction. I personally think that it's a worthwhile trade-off for most people, but there are some who disagree, and I think that ultimately it is an individual choice.
Have you ever faced a question like that yourself?
Well, I think fortunately for me, no. I have not had to face that kind of decision. I think my ongoing problem is a more common one. I'm the kind of artist who I'm a plodding writer. I work slowly. Insights come very, very slowly. And then most of the insights that I do have turn out to be cliched and banal and tiresome. And so my big problem is coping with my disappointment with myself and what I'm able to do. And I'm easily discouraged, and writing takes a long time for me. This book, for example, took 6 years to write, and during most of that time, I felt lost. I felt inadequate to the task, and during those stretches of time, I just get so discouraged that I wonder whether really I'm qualified to be doing this at all. And as far as I know, there's just not much out there that can help me in that situation. It's not that I have to make a choice. I just simply have to keep plodding on. But I've never had to face the kind of situation that this character faces, where she is given a medical option, a decision to make. I think it would be very difficult.
It seems from your books that you have a fairly obsessive personality and that you're kind of a serial obsessive, that you'll be obsessed with cello during one phase of your life and obsessed with martial arts during another and Chinese literature during another and writing during another. And I'm wondering if you've ever thought of your own obsessions as perhaps being part of a larger neurological problem.
No. Well, certainly I suspect that there is a...
I mean that partly lightly and partly seriously, in the sense that, I mean, there are people who are really obsessive, and on the one hand, it's part of their gift. They become
Absolutely.
So absorbed in their art that they, I mean, nothing can stop them. And on the other hand, they're that obsessive about the things that most people wouldn't let bother them, and that really gets in the way.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I'm sure that there is a neurological basis for that aspect of my personality, the fact that I do become so deeply involved with things, and I just can't let go until I've squeezed whatever it is that I feel is there out of them and absorbed it. And just as you say, there's a good side to that and a bad side. The good side is that when I start a book, I cannot let go of it until it's done, and that's a good thing. But it also means that little petty problems can really disturb me and keep me from being, you know, open to wonderful experiences. That definitely is a problem that I have. And I'm sure that there is someday they're going to have an explanation. Well, it's because this area of the brain of his does this and that. But as of yet, there's not much I can do about it. I just have to live with the flip side to it and appreciate the good side to it.
Writer Mark Salzman is my guest, and his new novel is called Lying Awake. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Salzman, whose new novel, Lying Awake, is about a Carmelite nun who learns that her mystical visions may be the result of a brain tumor causing epilepsy. Mark, how does your character, Sister John, resolve the problem about whether to have the brain tumor that may be causing her visions removed or not?
Well, I'm afraid that if I answer the question, then listeners who haven't read the book, it will take some of the drama out of the experience of reading the book, because that is the central conflict. It's the central question of the novel, is what is the right thing to do? What I can say about it is that being a nun, of course, she asks God for an answer, but God remains silent, and so she is forced to rely on her human instincts to reach the best decision, the decision of what is right. Is it right to do what's best for her personally, or what's best for others?
Now, you did some research for this novel, and some of that revolved around visiting with Carmelite nuns. Would you describe the order?
Well, the cloistered Carmelites are an order of nuns who they limit the number of members of each community. I think 21 is the top end, because they want it to remain a small community that can remain focused on prayer and contemplation. They follow a very, very strict schedule, beginning usually 5:30 in the morning, maybe even earlier. And what they're doing throughout the day is they're alternating between meeting in choir and reading the Liturgy of the Hours, which is the official prayers of the church, and then private prayer in their cells, and then manual labor. They support themselves through the manual labor, usually making bread or jams or communion wafers, that kind of thing. And their mission is to try to search for God by so simplifying their lives, so quieting their own minds, that they then can listen for the richness and the significance that's contained in any given moment, as opposed to searching for it in extraordinary moments. And so their life is about trying to find the sacred in the ordinary. At least that's my impression.
Now, there are characters in your novel who have doubts and have to deal with doubts. Did any of the nuns that you spoke with share any doubts with you?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that impressed me so deeply about them is that because they must face, they are in a sense alone with God's silence every day, and God's mystery, so to speak, that there can be no deceiving themselves about the truth of the fact that God is silent so much of the time. And in that silence, you have a sense that you're walking through darkness. There are times in life when you're walking blind, when you don't really know if the path you've chosen is right, and then you do have doubt. But it is during those moments of doubt that your real faith is exercised. That's how they put it to me. And so they were very upfront about the fact that, I remember in one of my first interviews with the prioress of a monastery, I said, "What do you think is the most difficult thing about cloistered living, monastic life?" And I thought she would describe certain details or maybe the physical discomfort and everything. And the first thing she said was doubt, because we must face our doubts every day. We don't have enough distractions to prevent our having to face our own doubts. And living with doubt, that is the difficult part.
Did any of the nuns that you spoke with have visions that they discussed with you?
I think all of the nuns that I spoke to were quite happy to say that they experienced a sense of God's presence at certain moments in their lives there, but none of them described those experiences in real detail, because I think what they feel is that those are not the main point of contemplative life. there are things that you enjoy and there are things you're grateful for, but I think what they wanted to emphasize to me was the requirement of trying to be attentive to God's mystery in even the most ordinary, non-vision-like moments. You know, doing laundry, washing vegetables, those kind of tasks, that's their real goal, is to try and feel appreciative of mystery in even those ordinary moments. So they didn't really dwell on the mystical aspects of their life.
Mark Salzman's new novel is called Lying Awake. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Mark Salzman. His new novel, Lying Awake, is about a Carmelite nun who learns that her divine visions may really be the result of a brain tumor that has caused a form of epilepsy. What did you do for your novel to learn about neurology?
Oh, that was fun. Mainly just call up neurologists and ask if they'd be willing to talk to me about this and answer questions. Reading, of course, but the real fun was meeting with neurologists and having them take me around the hospital on rounds letting me hear how they would work with patients with these seizure disorders. And then they're telling me stories about patients that they'd had. For example, one doctor had a wonderful story of a woman who came to him. And her symptoms were that she was experiencing multiple spontaneous orgasms. And they could happen at any time. She could be driving. She could be just watching television. And suddenly, one, two, three, four, five orgasms. So she went to the doctor. And after several tests, they found that she had temporal lobe epilepsy. The seizures were taking the form of orgasms. That's how she experienced them. And so she asked the doctor, what should I do? And the doctor said, well, if I were you, I wouldn't give up the freebies. And so she has decided against treatment. She goes to the doctor about every 6 months just to make sure that the seizures are staying localized in that temporal lobe area of the brain, that they aren't spreading, becoming more serious. But their mutual decision was that it wasn't harmful. Why not enjoy it?
The first paragraph of a previous novel that you wrote, The Soloist, has to do with the same theme that your new book, Lying Awake, is about. In the first paragraph, it starts, "This morning I read an article suggesting that St. Teresa of Avila, a 16th century Spanish mystic noted for her ecstatic visions, suffered from a neurological disorder known to cause hallucinations." And then the friend of the main character says, "Well, I bet it's just a matter of time before they prove that most of those saints had their wires crossed, along with a lot of artists." Now, do you share that opinion that, you know, like St. Joan, like Joan of Arc was really a schizophrenic who was hearing voices, and that, you know, if you tracked all the religious people and saints who heard voices or had visions, you'd probably find there was a neurological disorder behind it?
Well, yes and no. I agree with the idea that there is a physiological basis for all human experience, all conscious experience, whether it's extraordinary or not. And so extraordinary experiences, I think that there eventually we will find that there is a neurologic component to what is going on. But where I disagree is that I don't think that means that those experiences are invalid. For example, Van Gogh clearly had some kind of neurologic disorder, but we don't discount the validity, the beauty of his paintings because of that. Recently, there was a magazine article where a group of scientists wired up a Tibetan Buddhist, and they were able to visualize with this high-tech equipment what goes on in his brain during the deepest state of meditation. Now, just because you can do that, though, doesn't mean that that state of meditation isn't good, that it isn't healthy, it isn't valid. I don't think that a scientific way of looking at spiritual experience in any way threatens the validity of it or the beauty of it.
You know, you said before that one of the problems you face as a writer is that you sometimes think your work is plodding and that you're disappointed in your own ability, and you have to overcome that in order to continue. How do you take criticism? Like, say you send a draft to an editor or a trusted friend who functions as a reader for you, and they're being very honest with you, and they say that they don't really like it or they don't like this chapter or whatever. Does that spur you on to rewrite it and do a better job, or do you face like several months of just feeling crushed after that?
Yeah, the latter. I've had politeness pounded into me enough that I can put on a good face when I'm criticized, but inside I'm torn apart. And what usually happens is that I don't then immediately set down to work and say, okay, this is a challenge. I'm going to rise to meet this challenge. Usually I just feel, what's the point? I'm never going to get this right. And I do feel very low and kind of paralyzed for a while. But eventually I have enough of wallowing in that kind of misery. I can't stand it anymore, and the only way out is to fight my way out. So I do generally come back. But I do think that the theme throughout all my books, and I wasn't conscious of it. I'm never conscious of it at the time, but looking back, the theme that runs throughout all my books is how do we move on in life when we find ourselves facing the terrible gap between who we really are and who we had hoped to become? I think one of my first real experiences of this kind of disappointment was I grew up thinking I would be a concert cellist. So I played the cello right up until the end of high school, and then I applied to college as a music major, thinking that I would major in music. But right before going to college, I went to hear Yo-Yo Ma play at Tanglewood. I thought it would inspire me. 5 minutes into the first movement of the piece he was playing, it was the 5th Bach unaccompanied cello suite in C minor. I'll never forget it. My career as a cellist was over. And it was not because of his superhuman technique. I mean, he does have that. That's what people talk about when they talk about Yo-Yo Ma a lot. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. What really devastated me was seeing how deeply he was enjoying himself. He was freed by the music. He was in love with the music. It wasn't about him. It was about this wonderful music. And that's when I realized that for me, I had never felt that way when I played the cello. I felt that way when I listened to music. But when I played, it was always just about not making mistakes. It was about trying to impress people and finally have an adult identity. I think my playing was to music what a resume is to real writing. And that disappointment, that shook me really deeply. And I think that that comes up again and again in both my work and then in my daily life.
Now, you grew up in a family that you've described as non-religious. Which non-religion was it?
Well, my grandparents on both my parents' side were Protestant, but both my parents, to the best of my understanding, were just never really felt involved in religion. And so when we were brought up, it just really wasn't talked about that much. In elementary school, I was sent to the principal's office because on my way to school, it was on show and tell day and I had nothing to show. And I found a stamp on the ground. I was delighted because it was a foreign stamp that was good enough for show and tell. So I stood up in front of the class and showed this stamp, and it had an old man with a beard kneeling on the ground and a shiny white star in the sky. And there were the foreign words, Holy Bible, which I explained to the class. Well, it was Holy Bible. I had just never read those. I didn't recognize those words. And so, of course, the teacher assumed I was being, stupid. And so she sent me to the principal's office. So, I think when I started writing this book, all I really knew about Christianity was what I'd learned from Linus's speech in a Charlie Brown Christmas special. So I had a lot of ground to cover.
But you went through a period where you became quite absorbed in Zen Buddhism.
Yes. After seeing a kung fu movie when I was a kid, then I started getting curious about Chinese culture, and eventually what it all ended up focusing on was Asian philosophy, specifically Zen Buddhism. And what appealed to me about Zen was that here was a non-deistic philosophy. There wasn't the idea of a deity that I couldn't wrap my mind around, that nevertheless seemed to offer a means by which you could live fully. You could be fully awake every moment of life, as opposed to only during those peak moments that come so rarely. And and of course, ultimately what I hoped is that if I could become enlightened, if I could understand the oneness of the universe and be natural in every situation, then I would become dateable. I mean, that's what it kind of all boiled down to as a teenager, is that I was the smallest boy in my class. And so when I would ask girls on dates, the response usually was, you're like a little brother to me. So then I decided if I could become an enlightened Buddhist master, a kung fu monk, then I would be dateable. So I went through all of this, trying to learn all these things, meditating, kicking. And then when I asked girls on dates, their answer was, you're like a weird little brother to me. So it didn't work directly, but at least it gave me something to be passionate about.
You know, in your memoir about coming of age, you write a little bit about how, you know, these kung fu movies and how you started taking up kung fu and the other things that went along with it. And you say that you got very involved in it and then you stopped. And you write, when kung fu practice stopped, everything else followed. I stopped rush painting. All of a sudden, I wondered, why the hell am I painting little guys with robes and topknots staring at waterfalls? I've never even seen a waterfall, let alone a guy with a topknot. I put the Chinese history and philosophy books into the crawl space. Now, I'm wondering, since there's been a couple of things that you've picked up with great passion and then dropped, I'm wondering about how hard it is to drop something that you've been obsessive about, because it usually goes along with a whole constellation of other things, including your identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think of it as hard to drop something that you're obsessed about, because it usually happens without my wanting it to be that way. It's not that I choose to drop something. It's that I become so disappointed in myself. I become so hyper-aware that my motivations for wanting that very thing in the first place were selfish and wrong, that I just get so disgusted and angry that I cannot bring myself to continue with whatever it is that I've started without just feeling like a fool, without being reminded of all the mistakes I've made. Now, nicely, for me, what seems to happen is, though, is I'll drop something, but then it reappears later in life in a gentler and maybe a more mature way. I seem to have to, you know, that seems to be my pattern. I start at something white hot, and then I kind of burn out, and I put it aside, but then it reappears later, and then I'm able to really savor the value of it in a better way. So I would say that all of these things, cello, martial arts, that I mentioned as having dropped, or astronomy, they've all now come back, and now they're all now they're more incorporated into a more balanced life, I'd say. But that just means that I'm going to find something new to get all excited about. So who knows what that next thing will be.
Mark Salzman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Salzman's new novel is called Lying Awake. This is Fresh Air.